Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and I want to thank you for joining me here today for episode number 544. In a few moments, I'll share my conversation with Jamie Thrower, who is the founder of the Queer Grief Club, and we have a great discussion about providing care for the LGBTQ plus community at the end of life and how we can look at biases within our organizations and make sure that the care we offer is inclusive and also why that's very important. And I think you'll really enjoy this conversation. Jamie's amazing. I love talking to her, as you will hear, and I would be thrilled to have her back on the podcast again on a regular basis. So stay tuned. You're going to really like this conversation. And I will leave a link in the show notes for Jamie's website so you can get resources from her, but also Jamie's shop where she offers some really unique items, and a couple I talk about during the podcast, but just to let you know, some enamel pins, one that is a beautiful dove that says mourning on it, a mourning dove, and also a sticker that I'm in love with that says introverted but willing to talk about death and dying. And that's one of my very favorite stickers. I would almost like to have all my clothing say that and walk around with that to let people know I'm definitely introverted, but if you want to talk about death, you've got me. I'll sit down with you for hours. So you can go to the website, eolupodcast.com, and look for episode number 544, and you'll find links there for Jamie's website and for other things going on that you might want to know about, and you can read the rest of the show notes there as well. And today I'd like to thank Wayne for buying me a coffee, and also Rick DiTullio and Don Dater for making donations through PayPal. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It means everything to me when people are willing to offer just a small contribution to help keep this show on the air. It lets me know that you're listening and that you appreciate what I do. And that alone is really helpful, because sometimes this is lonely work sitting here creating content, producing episodes, and I don't always know if anyone's out there listening, and that's probably the best message you could ever send, is just to let me know that you hear what I'm doing and you appreciate it. So thanks in advance. If you're interested in making a similar contribution, you can go to eoluniversity.com/support, and you'll find there three different ways that you can make a contribution. And I really appreciate it in advance if you decide to do that. Also, don't forget there is a YouTube channel that goes with this podcast, also named End of Life University. So if you like watching videos, you can go to YouTube and you'll be able to see the guest and me as we talk to one another. And so I hope you'll check it out if you are one of the many people who really enjoy videos. So we will move on now with my conversation with Jamie Thrower. I'll be back afterwards with a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Today, I'm so excited to welcome back my very special guest, Jamie Thrower. Jamie is a queer death doula, end-of-life educator, and community grief tender serving the LGBTQ plus community in life and in death. In addition to working alongside dying people and their loved ones, Jamie also runs Queer Grief Club, an online advocacy, education, and support space for queer and trans folks. She is also the co-creator of the Dementia Deck, and we met already, and Jamie was here last year with Lisa Paul talking about the Dementia Deck, which is why I had to have her come back on as a guest. And you can learn more about all of Jamie's work at her website, Jamie Thrower, thrower.com. So Jamie, welcome back, and I'm so excited to talk to you.
Thank you so much. I'm so thrilled to be here.
Yeah, likewise. I've really been looking forward to our conversation because I was eager to focus in on the work that you are doing. And to begin with, to hear your story, what brought you to be working in this end of life arena?
Yeah. And I've been thinking about this question more, and I've actually been starting to investigate it and write a little bit more about it, because I think so often we are like, oh, how do you get into end of life work? Which I feel like for most of us, we were initiated into it through some sort of personal experience that we had. And as someone who grew up with death all around me in just like circumstantial things, and I was a very sensitive kid, and I'm realizing now that I was fascinated by death and I was also terrified of it, but it was something that I felt like I wanted to be close to, even though it was hard. And I didn't always have the language for that, but I think about one of my first very palpable grief experiences that I can remember is losing my childhood dogs when I was in kindergarten. And all I wanted to do was just go home or go to school. And I wanted to create little booklets and write stories about them and just quietly cry to myself. And unfortunately, the educators in the space thought that I should probably be at home and I'm maybe not okay to be at school. And it was really eye-opening to me that was like just engaging with what had happened. And I wasn't necessarily having outbursts or meltdowns. I was just letting the tears fall. And I was just writing stories and drawing pictures about my dog. And it was really, oh no, you do that at home with your parents. And so as I started to grow up and more people, and especially caregivers in my life, were dying or were getting serious illnesses, I just walked through the world feeling like everything was very impermanent for a very long time. And my mom grew up as the oldest of 10 kids, but at the time that she lost her mother, she was 11 years old and she was the oldest of 8. And she talked a lot about her mother because she wanted us as kids to know her mom through the way that she talked about her. But she also talked about how strange it was to be a kid and to be grieving and for the grief experiences to be really taken away from her. She wasn't allowed to go to the funeral. She was treated really differently at school. She was expected to suddenly be in a caretaker role for her family. All the pictures of her mom were taken down. And so it was really important, I think, because she was diagnosed with cancer. My mom was diagnosed with cancer when I was 10. And I think she worried about that same trajectory happening to her and her kids of, I might die and I want my kids to remember me. And so it felt like our whole life was like a legacy project to each other. And it was really beautiful, but it also, from just internalizing the messages that my mom was giving me, it was like, you show up to the funeral. I don't care if it's hard for you. It's harder for them. And I want you to be a part of whatever experience, death experience this is, in the way that makes sense for you. And so when my dad also got ill, I really wanted to be involved with caretaking. I wanted to be involved with his end of life process. And he was incredible. And he was such a charismatic and wonderful human being who was diagnosed with a terminal neurodegenerative disease similar to ALS. And so he was slowly but surely having his autonomy taken away and the functions of his body taken away. So again, it was like, how do we preserve what we have while we have? And how do we prepare for the future and face it knowing that there's no way we can escape this? There is nothing we can do. This disease is not curable. And so how do we make sure that, one, there are things that we as the kids get to have in the future that are going to remind us of our dad, our conversations that we had, but then also, like, how can we plan his funeral in a way that he actually wants? And I didn't realize it at the time, that was maybe revolutionary, but like picking the songs that he wanted to have played, which included the Rolling Stones' You Can't Always Get What You Want, as the casket is coming out of the church, and wanting very specific things that weren't necessarily traditional, but were still like so authentically true to him. And so it really, I think as I've moved through this world, I have found like this inner strength that I didn't really know that I had when I'm in the death and dying sphere. And it doesn't mean that I'm not fearful or I don't even recognize it for the mysterious, huge thing that it is, but I also know that it's so important. And I've watched and experienced so many people have their lives cut short or who have lived long, wonderful lives, but the way our humanity and this one life that we have is so short and so precious. And when we get to this point of dying, everything just goes out, like explodes, and people are so worried, and there's so much miseducation and not enough education and not enough support and not enough giving permission for people to be a part of that experience. And so I think that's, I've realized that like by being a part of my parents' death experiences, it was really a powerful and really connective experience for me, even though it was also something that was incredibly hard and gave me things that like trauma and experiences that I would not like to relive. And this is such a fundamental part of being human. So why are we not encouraging ourselves and each other to show up for these moments and to do it so that we don't have to do it alone, like to hold each other, to walk each other through this process. And as I went through my life, both of my parents died by the time I was 28 and they died 7 years apart from each other. And so by the time that I was parentless, I didn't match any of my other peers. Like they were just starting to lose their grandparents. Maybe someone had a dead parent, but that was pretty rare. And so as people were starting to lose their grandparents or their parents were diagnosed with serious illness, I was able to connect with them in a way that no one else within our peer group could. And that's, again, where I realized this is the hardest thing I will carry for the rest of my life. And this is a magic way of connecting with people in a way that I couldn't have ever experienced if I didn't know all this grief and loss and death. And so it's been really beautiful to always have had this role be my community role, be the role that I play within my friends and family and kind of larger people. And then many years ago, when the idea of a death doula was introduced, and someone actually, whoever introduced it to me, was like, this is already what you do. And I was like, oh, yes. And that's like, my gosh, like what a perfect role and what a perfect kind of name for it. Because I've always felt like I've straddled many different lines in the ways that I support people. I'm not medical and I'm not a therapist. But I'm also like, I can be a peer and I can be a mentor. I can be an educator. I can be an artist who comes and helps. I can be a photographer. I can be all of these different things. And it's been really beautiful to watch it all unfold.
Wow. Your story, it's so poignant and so profound and such experience of deep loss at such a young age. But it does feel as if you were being called and initiated from the beginning.
Yeah.
Into this work. And it tells me that if we were doing a better job of helping our children and educating them about life and the natural losses that it brings to us, life and death, and helping them with grief at a young age, it would change the trajectory of their entire life. And they would not have to go through so much panic later on when someone they love becomes ill or they become ill, because they will have been aware and present with illness and death for their whole lives. And instead, I feel like we still in many ways shield children from that experience.
Yeah, we really do. And that's a question I get a lot now as a death doula. I have a kid. How much do I let them be involved in this process? And for me, I feel like it's so important to let kids lead the way. And I've seen so many profound and beautiful moments of kids connecting with someone who is dying, being able to give them something that is a moment of joy or a piece of wisdom or just like some sort of comfort that an adult really couldn't do. And then I've also like talking to kids about death. makes so much more sense oftentimes to me than it does trying to talk to adults about it. Because kids' minds are still so open a little bit to this possibility that there are many possibilities. And I think as we grow up, we narrow our worlds and we get all these different stories and these things that we believe. And then we like really struggle with what to do with these unanswered questions or these questions that don't have like clean and perfect answers. And so I think because sometimes kids elicit that kind of, I don't know, like how many times does a child ask you like questions? You're like, I don't know, but actually that's a really good question. I think we end up shutting kids down or trying to protect them from something that is inevitably part of life. And there are so many ways to integrate a child into a death experience in a way that is emotionally and socially appropriate for them in that moment, but without just shielding them and protecting them from something that they really don't need protecting from.
And I loved your story of going to school and just wanting to draw pictures and write stories about your dogs. Like, kids have their own natural way of grieving that they're actually comfortable with. And I feel like the adults there are really shielding themselves, not the child. They're shielding themselves from their own discomfort with grief and not knowing how to talk about it. So they try to shut it off for the child when actually the child would probably handle it better than the adults do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we're so quick to, like, we want to fix grief. We want to have an answer. We want to be able to say something that makes someone stop crying and be able to be happy. And grief doesn't work like that. Like, I'm always like, grief doesn't work like that. And one of the most powerful things we can do is sit in the discomfort of it, is to sit in the hard place with someone and say, I wish I knew too, or I hate this too. And I imagine that kids and adults and everyone in between would really benefit so much more from learning how to just sit with that discomfort rather than brush it off or try to change it or try to quickly move to a different avenue where they don't have to feel it. Like, we really need more experiences actually where we can sit with something really hard and other people are gonna just hold us in that.
Yeah. Hold us in the middle of the why.
Yeah.
We don't have answers for everything. We're just sitting in the middle of asking why and we just don't know.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's really beautiful. And I'm just so taken with your whole journey and how you've been true to it, how you have lived it as your passion. And that one day, I love that the term death doula gave you in a way to describe what you do that may have been hard to talk about or tell other people, but suddenly now it has a name. And there's some validity to it, at least. We can talk about it. We can talk about it as a particular path.
Yeah. And now it's showing that it's really valuable, right? Like, it's not just something that like, oh, you're just the weird kid who will talk about death with people, or you're just someone who's experienced a lot of loss, so you can probably relate. But we are seeing in real time how death doulas are both giving better death experiences or advocating for better death experiences for people. But also in the same way, we are advocating for better life experiences. Like, to me, being able to know about what we face at end of life and the things that people question and what they work through and the struggles makes me really rethink and reprioritize what's important to me right now in this moment. And it helps me also encourage others and fight for other people. I'm like, this one life is so precious. And we should make it as wonderful and accessible and supportive for everyone as we can, because who knows what happens next?
Yeah, so very true. And I know in your work as a queer death doula, you emphasize creating inclusive spaces where everyone can feel represented and like they belong. And sadly, even in the end of life community, we still don't really have that for everyone. It's really something we have to be working on intentionally in order to improve that and to improve how we open the doors and how we welcome people. And so I wanted you to talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I've always tried to have a lens through which I see the world. And for so long, it always was through a queer lens. And before I was doing death doula work, I had been working as a photographer. And the moment that I switched my career over to just working with queer and trans folks who are getting married and explaining the differences of it is really helpful to have someone who knows you, where you don't have to walk into a wedding venue and they say, okay, who's the bride, who's the groom? And that doesn't fit not all of these kind of structures of life that we have in this world, like actually fit the narrative for the stories and the experiences that people are having. And so as I got more into death and grief work, and of course, saw the ways in which like there were many different experiences that I was having that my peers or that other people in my grief groups weren't having. What was the most eye-opening experience to me was when my partner and I lost a baby in 2020, and it was a really traumatic loss, and it was both in the emergency room care that we received and the aftercare that we received. It was horrific and traumatizing, and they added on so many layers of just like unnecessary homophobia. And I really was like, how is this possible that we are experiencing one of the most profound things that like a couple can go through when they are intentionally bringing a child into this world? And we were like very well into the second trimester. So it was so unexpected. And to watch people truly clamor over themselves to go away from our grief or to not even mention it, and then to start looking for grief support groups, and everything was very gendered and very pointed towards, yes, dads can come, or yes, husbands are welcome, or the dads group has to be really separate. And to me, I was, as the person who didn't carry, I was like, where do I go? If I go to a pregnancy loss and stillbirth group, if they find out that it didn't happen to my body, does that change things? Yeah. If I show up to a dad's group, we might share some experiences, but also do I get to be there? And so it became this place of like, where does my grief get to exist? And with all of the layers and all of the things that happen as a result of it. And so I started Queer Grief Club I just changed my Instagram handle to Queer Grief Club. I was already doing like end of life doula work and kind of death education work. And I was like, I need to share more what it is like to experience grief as a queer person. And when I lost my parents, like I wasn't out yet when my dad died. I wasn't like fully out. And with my mom, it was still something that I hadn't fully figured out what it meant to me. Like to me, I was like, okay, this is just my sexual orientation, whatever. And then in the more years that I have done more self-work and realized that there are so many ways in which my world is shaped by how I love people and the ways that I relate to gender and family and all these different things. And so I was like, okay, so finding kind of my queer identity was really huge. And then the experience of grief within that, I was like, wow, there's so many layers. And so when I started talking about that and the ways in which I couldn't feel like I found support or that the grief was really unacknowledged, and started opening up more spaces for conversations around that, people really started flooding in and being like, yeah, like I want to go to a grief support group for my chosen mom, but I don't know if I can do that because I feel like I'm going to have to justify whether we were close enough to be in the group. Or what happens when I'm grieving my dad, but my dad disowned me for being gay? I don't know how to grieve that. What does that even mean? What grief group do I belong to? And as the more conversations that were happening and the more that I also started specifically working with the LGBTQ community at the end of life, was realizing that is its own grief experience as well. Like so many, there are studies about how many people end up going back in the closet when they go into a retirement home or when they go to receive medical care. People really hide their identities. People are really fearful of practitioners or of hospice teams or of chaplains because they're worried that they're not going to get the adequate care. And so for me, I'm like, I don't want that burden to be on those people. What we can do is we can open up more spaces and we can continue to educate the providers and the care teams and the people of like how to love us and care for us at end of life and in grief. And there's so many simple ways to do that, right? It's just like expanding our minds and expanding our definitions of things. And grief never fits neatly into a box. Like it never has and it never will. And I think one of the things that makes like queer and trans people unique to hold this space is that we also have this legacy of loss and this legacy of using our grief as this vehicle for change and connection with each other. And so there's so many rich things when you start to look into and really examine kind of the intricacies and what intersects and all the ways in which queerness and grief go hand in hand and how they can both, like how we can learn from grief and how we can learn about our grief through kind of our queerness and the way we show up to the world. Anyways, we've had to reimagine so much for ourselves. We reimagine relationships and our own gender journeys and all of these different things. And so grief oftentimes is asking us to reimagine a relationship or an identity or a way of moving through the world. And it's not without holding a lot of space for what is lost, but then also making more space for what is also found in that time.
That's really beautiful. And I wanted to ask specifically about the Queer Grief Club. It's online, is that right? It's an online community that gathers.
Yeah. So I can't remember how long, at some point I was like, I think I'm going to have a grief group if anyone comes, and it can just be informal and we'll just be together, because that to me is always just made sense, that hearing from other people who have experienced something similar to me or who can at least sit in the, this sucks part. And so I put a call out there and people came and we were like, we should do this monthly. And so now for the last couple of years, I've been hosting the Queer Grief Club, and it is a monthly kind of support space. It's an open kind of drop-in, show up as you are. And we get to really talk about what kind of grief is coming up for us right now. And it can be so many different types of grief. Or what grief do you not get to talk about in your world? Or just being able to be amongst a community of peers and people who are showing up in the world similarly to you, and to just feel a little less alone in it. And so it's evolved into, I also have one specifically for pet loss, because that has also been a huge place where I think queer experiences really play into the ways we relate to our pets and the relationships that we have with them. And then through that, through opening up space for people to just have a support space, I also was like, how do we just find ways to be together? So I was running in-person groups, whether that was come and do yoga on a farm and we'll talk about grief for a little bit, or let's do collage, or I'm going to hang out at this coffee shop on Sunday and anyone who wants to come and join me, I'll be your grief buddy. And I have felt since I was young and grieving that grief groups needed to be shaken up a little bit. Yes, it is important to go to, but I didn't always want to go sit in the church basement or somewhere under like fluorescent lighting to hold my grief. And I wanted to move it in different ways, but mostly wanted to connect with different people. And so we've done all sorts of activities and meetups. And now I love collaborating with other people to do workshops and just to be able to have more space where we can be together as queer people, where we can talk about grief without filter, without worrying about who we might confuse, And we get to like also share in each other's joys and heartbreaks and build a really beautiful community through that. Mm. So it's so special to me to just see this network growing and this, and just the ways in which we hold each other when we meet together.
Wow, that's so beautiful. I was just thinking how you're creating a space where you can still write the stories. You can draw the pictures that you wanted to draw when you were a kid.
Yes.
And you knew this is a way to process grief. This is a really important type of ritual for grieving that people around you just didn't recognize.
Yeah, absolutely. And for so many people, like sometimes even just sitting and talking isn't accessible for them, or they don't even know what this grief means for them quite yet or how to relate to it. But hearing, listening to other stories and drawing is really helpful in that moment, or maybe just being present and just letting the tears fall as you are hearing other people's experiences or stories that are similar to yours. Like, I really talk a lot in the group about how there's so many ways to be present with grief, and there's no one right way to do it. So if all you do is just get yourself here today and you keep your camera off and you're just like staying cozy with a blanket and absorbing, that is a beautiful way to start. And we get to also build our relationship with grief. And that's been the fundamental thing that I've learned, is that grief is not this thing that I'm trying to get rid of. I'm not trying to make it go away, but I'm just trying to make softer spaces for it to land, like in my personal life and outside of that. And so how do we just let ourselves show up for our grief in many different ways, but especially in ways that are safe and affirming for ourselves? Because grief is oftentimes feels so unconsensual, feels so just coming at you all the time. You're like, I'm just trying to go to the grocery store. Why am I crying in the aisle again? And anytime that we can intentionally walk into grief space and let our bodies know it's okay, however you show up here is okay right now, I think that's giving us and our bodies and our minds like more clues and more information about how to build a relationship with this grief for the rest of our lives.
Wow. I find that really exciting. It feels like such a breath of fresh air in a way to think of these new, more open spaces where we can let grief flow however it wishes to and take whatever direction it needs to go in. But this conversation is also bringing up in me, I sometimes feel so bad about early days when I was involved in hospice, which is a long time ago now, but remembering that we had a male patient once whose caregiver was also a male, and they told us they were roommates and friends. And at the time, we might have wondered, okay. But honestly, we were so oblivious. It honestly didn't occur to us. And it does now. And I mean, I've been able to see this for a number of years now, but that how painful for them to have to hide the depth of their relationship, to not be able to talk about their grief in the same way. Oh, a friend who came to take care of someone grieves differently than a partner does, than a spouse does. And the fact that we could not show up for them, they needed to hide because we were not welcoming enough and we didn't understand or recognize it. And we didn't know how to allow them to be open and talk and to be real about what their situation was. And I'm just wondering, for people like me with good intentions, but who don't know for sure, how do we handle it? What should we say? How can we make our work more welcoming and feel supportive to people from the LGBTQ+ community when it isn't already built in, perhaps, to the system we're part of? What can we do as individuals?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, that is a good question, because it is not built into these systems that exist already, that I think many of us are trying to change. But how do we still exist within them and show ourselves to be safer people and people that they can trust? And I think a lot of it goes in many different directions. And I think one is my favorite question, which is that, what do I need to know about you in order to give you the best care? And knowing that, and also mentioning that nothing is off limits. I think a lot of times people worry that if they tell a hospice worker, any sort of medical person, something about themselves that maybe that person might not like that would change their treatment or change the way that they're being assessed or any of that stuff. So I think being able to also remind people that they get to show up with their full selves and then really not making assumptions. I think so often we have so many assumptions that are pushed on us or that are also like within forms and paperwork and just the questions that are asked. And so being willing to even think about the language that we use for those questions instead of saying, oh, where's your, do you have a husband? Were you ever married? Saying, do you have a spouse or do you have a partner? Is there someone in your life that romantically or platonically cares for you? And what does that relationship mean to you? Tell me about the people who are really important that you want to be here and tell me why they're important to you. I think so often we are also worried that people don't care or that they're willing to also dismiss our relationships because they assume that people will just think it's strange or that they won't understand it. But I remember your story made me think about this one person that I was working with, and their caregiver was always just, we were told it was their dear friend. And when it was just us and I had ended up disclosing that I was part of the queer community, and he immediately, like, his eyes lit up and he immediately was like, my caregiver is actually my ex-lover and we were together for so many years. And now, like, he has another husband and we're close, but we just, and I was like, yes, of course. Yeah, that's how it works in our community. One of my favorite things to read about, or that I read about Andrea Gibson, the beautiful trans poet who died, mm-hmm. that they had like at least three ex-girlfriends in the room with them when they were dying. And I was like, yep, that is how we do it. We like hold tight to our relationships, but they were scared to tell the rest of their team and people like the intricacies of their relationship because they were like, they might not understand or they might just think it's weird or they're going to try and find a box for my grief that doesn't really exist. And so I think there's a lot of debate, right, about, oh, are symbols helpful, like having things like a rainbow flag or showing those things. But I think that they can be, especially in healthcare and hospice settings, being able to show that you are an ally or that you are someone who can really support people, and doing that both in overt and covert ways. So like, I love working with groups, with hospices, to talk to their teams about pronoun use and like getting comfortable with using pronouns that they might not be fully comfortable with quite yet. And we can still learn and embrace that and what a difference it makes. Or if there are ways that people need to have more like allowances or just like support from their family, which is more chosen family, like being able to really make and accommodate space and value those relationships. And I think that is oftentimes one of the biggest things that queer and trans people face, is that like when we meet other people, it is either someone telling us that we don't know ourselves or that our relationships don't really matter. And so I think by being able to really express to people that who you are matters and I believe you, and who you love and who is important to you in your life also really matters, and they are valuable in this experience too. And so I think we build trust that way. And then we also go within our systems of, hey, how can we make this, our hospice, make sure that we are showing that we accept any sort of queer or trans people? Do we need to have a statement on our website that just explicitly says that, so that people can really feel like they are not guessing? Oh, I hope this place might be safe for me. I hope this place might, do I need to ask them what, if they have ever worked with a trans person before? So I think like we have to be both louder in our what we are putting out there, but also just to then be like softer in the ways we interact with people and the ways that we can also just learn how to show up for people just like without any sort of prejudgments already. And that's the mystery. That's how we have to show up for death and dying anyways, is like knowing that it's probably going to be different than we can expect, and like to come in with a really open mind and know that this is going to happen in the way that it unfolds, and how can I show up for this in this person in this moment. And so I think that we get to, as we meet new people in this life, to just to say, I want to know who you are in this moment, and who, like, all the things that I think and believe don't really matter, because this is about you. So I get to hold this with you and support you through this.
And I love that you use the word safety and trust, because I think that's a really good thing to always remember. Am I creating a place, a space in my work with people that feels safe to them? Can they feel safe with me? Can they trust me? And am I letting them know that? Am I actually demonstrating that you're safe with me? I think that's just so important to remember. And then also, each one of us also has to be willing to look at our unconscious bias that we may carry from society, from the family messages we were given, or however, whatever is there. All of us may have some of those biases that we're not even aware of, and we have to be willing to examine that.
Yes. In the same ways that like we have to examine the harder things of life, which are like the more that we look at something like death, like grief, it's not necessarily that we have to fully understand it, but we can show up for it in different ways, and we can relate to it in different ways, and we can go, I'm going to try this next time when I meet someone. And so I feel like by examining like our own biases or the things that we believe and what we have learned and what we are stuck by, what we struggle with, and we're so bad at asking for help, right? And we also are so nervous to be labeled as ignorant. So people end up not getting support or not asking how they can do it better. And I think that's what builds that safety and that trust, is that it's not a certain set of words or a very specific script that you are saying to your client. You are just showing that you're open to feedback. You're willing to apologize when something is, like when you make a mistake or something is misunderstood, you're willing to show like a lot of patience and grace and understanding and like creativity for like, how can we make this work for you? How can I help you understand this in a different way? And that's such a different experience than someone coming in and someone being like, this is what you need and this is what you should be doing. And I'm only going to call you by this name, and that you're just, am I even in the room? It's just, none of it is without mistake and without imperfection. And I think that's wonderful. And we need to really get more comfortable with the ways in which we can receive feedback from people, just about for anyone. And it's not just queer and trans people, but just for anyone. If someone is telling us something that they are needing in that moment, or a way of being, or all of these things, like, how can we receive that feedback and be able to show up and try again, or to work towards the repair that it really deserves? Knowing that some stuff is going to deserve big repair and some stuff is just going to be like, oh, sorry, wrong pronoun, got it. Anyways, let's keep talking. And so I think that's the beauty, is that it's all relational work.
Yeah.
You don't have to take a course in LGBTQ studies. You just have to constantly be working on like your relational work and the way you show up for humanity.
Yeah. Wow. That's such a good point. And it applies to everyone that we work with, since everyone is so different and unique. And I think there's a humility involved in that, to be willing to say, I probably will screw up. I'm going to say the wrong thing, or I'll be clumsy or awkward about something. But if I can say, wait a minute, could I say that over? I think I might have blown it when I said that and I didn't mean to. And that's how we all learn and grow together.
Yeah. Yeah. And it really establishes just like a safer space for us to all exist in when we get to show up and make mistakes and move forward from them with more, just more information about what to do next time.
Like, yeah.
Every mistake is information. Every interaction, every person that we come across is information. And so I think it's really beautiful to be able to think about the ways that we can really show up and love people while we're here.
Yeah. I on your website, I saw that you have a handout on queer and trans affirming additions for advanced directives.
Yeah.
That really caught my attention because I have a family member who's part of the LGBTQ plus community, and he and his partner are both getting older. They're developing health issues, and I don't think they have an advanced directive, and I want to talk to them about it and explain that it's really important that you just have these conversations and do this work. So I wanted to ask you about some of the tips that you might have for advanced directives.
Yeah, gosh, advanced directives have become such a important part of my work because I have worked especially with some younger people who have gotten serious illness or terminal illness, but also because I've seen friends or people who have experienced an accident or who have gone through something and they had no idea what their person wanted. And I've also seen people who have died in an accident and the wrong people were taking over their care and what to do. And they were people that totally changed, again, like who that person was and memorialized them in a really different way. So to me, I'm like, an advanced care plan is so important. There's two different parts. There's naming your healthcare proxy, and that to me feels important for people because not every person wants the law to determine or like the government to determine who's going to make decisions for you. And for a lot of people, and I say that like you should fill out an advanced directive at any age because you could get in an accident at any time. And who is the person that you would want to make decisions for you on your behalf? Is it your actual biological parents, or do you have someone that you really trust and who knows you and that would have your best interests in mind? So there's that. And I'm always encouraging people to make sure that they have the right people that would make decisions for them. But then when we get to talk about and we get into kind of the nitty gritty of both thinking about what scenarios might happen, what quality of life means, but then also how do I want to be treated at the end of my life? How do I want to be memorialized? Who do I want to be there? Who do I not want to be there? And so that's one of the first questions or one of the first things that I say to put in an advanced directive is if there is anyone that you do not want to be there, that you do not want any part of making medical decisions, even if they're just a bystander, write that in to protect yourself. And then writing in things about what is important, like the chosen family members or the people that you want to be a part of your experience. Anything about like the way that you present yourself, like your gender presentation, so that we're not letting people be unconsensually detransitioned in their death. Or what do you want done with your body? And do you know who would be making those decisions if you died? Because it might not be the same person as your healthcare proxy. So there's a form we can fill out to make sure that the right person does that. But what would you want your memorial service to look like? How do you want people to refer to you? And so even just writing in additions like, I want to make sure every medical provider is using my chosen name. I don't care that it doesn't match the one on my birth certificate. Or I want to make sure that my partner, and we're not married, but my partner is the person who makes the medical decisions. And I want them to do it with my two other closest friends. And I want them to do it as a team. And here's what's really important to me about my life now. And anything else that we want to add. So there's a lot of beautiful ways to just advocate for ourselves. There's even like I put in there almost like kind of notes to the person who would be the person who's making all those decisions of, yes, please do correct doctors or hospices if they're not using my correct pronouns. Or, yes, I want that to happen. And also, my mom will probably never recognize them. And that's okay. We have our own relationship. There's so much nuance and intricacy and so many different things that we can get creative and that we can also ask for at the end of our life. And I feel especially for queer people, we just don't know that we can ask for those things and we get nervous to ask for those things. And so I am always like, let the advance directive be a guide for how to love you and care for you if you can't tell people. Who are the people who are important to you? Who are the people that you want to be there? What are your preferences around touch and environment and care and all of those things? You could write in your advance directive, please try to find like a facility that is LGBTQ affirming, or I would really prefer to work with this group. And like, we can put in all of our wishes and things into an advance directive. It doesn't mean they're always going to be fulfilled, but it also gives so many clues and information for if someone is making that decision for us, what they can do to best honor us. So I'm always telling people there's nothing too detailed that you can put in there. Why not?
Yeah, those are great tips. And I'm going to download that for my family member, because I think that would be really helpful and beneficial to them. And we're already running out of time. I feel like we could just talk and talk. But there are just a couple of fun things I wanted to mention from your website. I saw that you have an enameled pin, a mourning dove pin that's very beautiful. And I'm going to order several of those because it seems like that's an amazing gift to give to someone who's grieving. And I've lately wished that we had these symbols. You talked about the rainbow flag as being a symbol for grieving that other people could see us wearing it and recognize, even a stranger we pass on the street would recognize, oh, that person must be grieving because of, imagine all of the hidden, invisible support that you could receive from people just passing by you or seeing you in the grocery store who recognize that person's grieving and they're sending you love and support energetically.
I've always been like, bring back mourning jewelry, bring back like the dress and like these symbols, because I think it is important and it is this beautiful way to show to people when we don't always have the words or we don't want to have the words that like, hey, I'm experiencing something. I'm in a different wavelength right now. And that really stemmed from my own desires of like, when I go to the store, or I go into a place and I just need people to know that I'm grieving also. And sometimes it is as little as just a pin. Like I have one that also says, please be gentle and kind. I'm grief in process. And I've heard from so many people who have used them that it's been so helpful for if they're in a customer facing job. And when someone notices that pin, they either redirect and they are a little gentler, or it opens up conversation and support in a way that was really unexpected and so beautiful. And I think so many of us are walking around the world holding so much intense grief and intense loss, and we still have to do our day-to-day things. And that's why we feel like we're losing our mind when someone asks us like, how are you doing at the grocery store? And you're like, I don't know how to tell you that I'm grieving and I don't want to be here. And I'm like, need to make myself dinner still. But when they can see that you have this pin and someone asks you like, how's your grief holding up today? Or I'm so sorry that you're grieving. I'm just sending you extra care. Hope that you get to have a cozy meal soon. That is such a different way of interacting and a more intimate like way of being in public when you are grieving, which oftentimes like you do. You already feel like you have a sign on your head that says, hello, I'm grieving, but no one can see it. I think it's really important to tell people when we're grieving, to show people when we're grieving, and to show that it also belongs in so many spaces, that we don't have to keep it inside. We don't have to keep it within the walls of even just a grief counselor's room that we get to let it be in public, that we get to show people that it is possible to grieve and continue to live our lives. And also, we are fundamentally changed, so be gentle with us.
Yeah.
Give us grace while we figure out how to relearn the world.
It's such a good reminder. And I think even for me as a person walking out in the world, sometimes when someone does something that seems rude, they steal my parking place or cut me off in traffic, and I want to feel angry. But honestly, if I understood what they were carrying, what they're going through, that they may be completely distracted, maybe they are grieving, I would have so much grace for them and so much compassion and forgiveness. And that if we can walk through the world carrying that attitude for everyone, even if they're not wearing a grieving pin, and we remember that everyone is carrying hard things, it changes how we treat one another.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And then another thing I saw that I love is a sticker that says, introverted but willing to discuss death and dying. And that's one of my favorite things, because as an introvert myself, it always seems like a contrast that, oh, I'm so shy and I don't want to talk about anything. Unless it's death. If you want to talk about that, let's sit down. We can really get into this.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm not great at small talk, but if you want to get into the deep and wild world of death and grief, let's go. Absolutely.
Here we go.
And I think that there are a lot of us who feel similarly. And like, I appreciate you mentioning my pins and stickers, and I make zines, and that's just been a part of my process as a griever, but also as a death doula, which is like, how can I make some products and things that like I deeply believe in and that feel like they are symbols, or they are ways to have that people can use to invite other people into their grief experiences, that they can be tools even of, oh, I saw that sticker on your water bottle, talk to me about death and dying. And then you find out that I'm a death doula, and then we have this really beautiful conversation. Or being able to give someone one of my zines about grief, and it feels a little like something a little bit more substantial than just a card, but like also it's not a whole book on grief, because who has the time or kind of bandwidth to read a book, but like a tiny little booklet, that's great too. And all of these things help me continue to do this work, especially with my community, who is oftentimes underserved and doesn't have like financial resources to pay for a lot of extra support. I'm always like, how can I think of other ways that I can support myself, so that when I'm providing in-person care, it really doesn't matter whether or not they have the resources to pay me. It's more about, do we both have capacity to work together? And so I'm always trying to get creative and find more ways to fund this work, but it's also such a joy to create these things, and allows me to reach people in really new ways too.
I love that you bring your whole self to the work that you do, all of your creativity. And I'll encourage people again to check out your website. First of all, like pins, stickers, zines, what great gifts they make. And it's worth having some on hand, because oftentimes someone you know is going through grief and you wish you had the perfect gift, but you don't know what that is. These are perfect gifts that you could give to someone. So I encourage people to go support your shop, but also go to your website to learn about events that you have, monthly events you have coming up online. The Queer Grief Club for one, but you have other workshops and events as well on your website.
Yeah, I do. So every month I host Queer Grief Club, both for any type of grief, general grief, all grief, and then one for pet loss. And then I'm just starting a series coming up with Lisa from the Death Deck and Catherine from Death Project Manager. And we started the series last year, and it's called Sick and Tired. And it's for people with chronic illness who want to discuss grief, or people with disability who want to discuss grief and the grief experiences that happen with that. And then I'm also starting a new series and some work with Lisa Kefauver of Grief is a Sneaky Bitch to talk about long-term caregiving and grief, and how that shapes our grief experiences, and how it plays into just the ways in which we, our identity changes, and just there's so many layers to caregiving. And then I also offer many different workshops about like preparing yourself for end of life, doing paperwork, being able to show up and care for someone who's dying, like being able to get support and tips from a death doula. So yeah, I encourage anyone, you can always find my workshops and events on my website, which you mentioned is jamiethrower.com. And I'm also always thinking of new events and workshops and things to do just to find all of the spaces and the intricacies and the ways in which we need to have more space to talk about grief and how it fits in our worlds and how we metabolize it and how we grow with it and how we help hold it together.
That's so wonderful. Jamie, it's just such a pleasure to talk with you. And I feel like now I need to have you back at least two more times because we haven't nearly covered all the topics we could discuss. It's been really fun.
It's been such a pleasure. And I'm just so grateful and so grateful for End of Life University and all that you do, because I think it's so important to encourage people both to do death education, but also to provide that death education to people and to folks who are in this world and who are not in this world. But the more that we can learn about death and grief, the better we can show up for it. And so I think it's just grateful to be here.
Yeah, thank you. And yeah, it's delightful to talk with you and share your work. And I hope people will check out your website and stay connected with you and all the things you're doing.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
You're so welcome.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jamie Thrower as much as I enjoyed talking with her. And she really reminded me of how careful we need to be to examine our own biases and really look at what we're offering to people. And even it makes me think about my websites and the conversations I have, the way I address certain issues. Am I being inclusive in my outreach to people? And as I confided in some of our work in hospice, of course, many years ago, it clearly was not inclusive. It was not welcoming to members of the queer community. And I hope we're doing a better job now, but it's so important for each one of us to become aware and just to notice how we're showing up for people of all sorts of groups to make sure that what we offer is something truly welcoming to everyone. So thanks again for joining me here and staying through the entire interview. I really appreciate it. If you enjoy this content, please share it with someone else who might benefit from listening in. And also leave a rating and review wherever you happen to listen. And I will be back in another week or two with another new interview for you. Until then, remember, we're here for love. That's really what this life is all about. And along with love comes grief. So we must be able to hold both of them in our hands as we navigate this life. Remember to face your fear, be ready for whatever life brings you next, and love each and every moment that you have a chance to be here in this precious life. Bye-bye.